Really lovely to see you, Helen. We've already met for a coffee, and we were almost going to be late because we're going to be talking too much upstairs. So Helen wrote this book, Cynical Theories, which you can see all, I won't show you all my underlinings, but there's a lot of underlinings. It's one of those books that I read, and just, you know how you read a book, sometimes you just think, that's really brilliant. Everyone's going to love this. You know, the first bit, the first bit I was dead on. Second bit, not so good on the everyone's going to love it thing. It's just for me, it's an exciting, properly reasoned piece of work. You know, a proper bit of thought. And one of the things that I want to try to promote as much as I can is a world in which we try to think. One of my larger concerns is that people aren't reading. And if people aren't reading, then they're often sort of not thinking. Yeah. When I go on the tube now, if I see someone with a book, I'm tempted to embrace them. But that would create other kinds of issues, so we won't go there. I thought we'd start actually with saying a little bit more about why we have Philosophy East here at the London Buddhist Centre. I've already run to, and it never occurred to me to do that. Because obviously why we have it, but I thought I'd try and say a little bit more of why. So this is a little discourse in Buddhism, really, and I hope Helen won't mind. I did warn her. So Buddhism has always been concerned about view, yeah, the kind of views you take up. The traditional word for the Sanskrit word for that is drishti. And by view, Buddhism doesn't mean necessarily, although it includes it, but doesn't necessarily mean the kind of opinions you have, the things you share on Instagram. It's not just about the opinions you have. It's a marvelous metaphor, isn't it? View means your kind of perspective on life. So you see life in a certain way, and how you see life shapes how you live life. Yeah. So for instance, if I come down and tell you how I've had this incredible promotion at work and I've now got this really well-paid job, you won't know whether to clap or not, depending on your view. If you have a view that thinks that promotion and money accumulation are values, you will think that's really great that I've got a promotion and I've got that value. But if you don't particularly think that, you'll just think, okay, you know, you won't know what to think. You won't know whether to celebrate or not, depending on your view. And view is a kind of pre-conscious pattern maker. Yeah. So view is very important in Buddhism. In a certain sense, it's one of the most important things about Buddhism is a clarity about view, which means not, as I say, your opinion, but your perspective on life. Yeah, how you see things and how that makes you act. So Buddhism talks of a journey from wrong view to right view to sometimes called perfect vision or even no view. Yeah, that's from the point of view of view, that's the Buddhist journey. The simple way of translating that is from unhelpful views that stifle growth, that cause conflict, that make you make you more egoistic, make you more selfish, more vainglorious, negative, or views that help you connect with things, connect with people, open up to things. Yeah. So you've got unhelpful views. So a classic unhelpful view would be that actions don't have consequences. You know, that's a classic Buddhist unhelpful view. Actions don't have consequences. In the westernized world, we tend to think, no, that's probably true. But particularly we think, it's fine if I don't get caught. So, you know, a bit of peppy thieving from the office doesn't really matter as long as I don't get caught. Yeah, that doesn't matter. Our westernized view is a kind of legal view. Buddhism is saying, actually, no, your actions matter. What you think matters, what you say matters, what you do, irrespective of whether you get caught. Yeah, that's a simple example of a wrong view. And a right view is simply, that what you think matters, what you say matters, how you treat people matters, actually matters. Again, whatever people think, however people are horrid to you, if you're generous to them and kind to them, that matters. Yeah, Buddhism is rigorous in not giving you an excuse to be unpleasant or hateful or something. It's absolutely rigorous in that, to an almost unimaginable degree, but I won't go there just now. And of course, what the practice of Buddhism is moving from unhelpful wrong view to helpful right view. But even right view, from a Buddhist point of view, isn't how things really are. Because how things really are, from a Buddhist point of view, is beyond language, beyond language constructions, beyond any kind of discourse. So you can't say anything about it, by definition. The Buddha traditionally had no view. In other words, he didn't have to think about what he thought about things. He just met a person as he found them and spoke to them without any pre-existing view of one of any kind. Yeah? So it's sort of an unimaginable place. So in creating Philosophy East, I've tried to invite people who I think have got some degree of coincidence with Buddhist right view. That's what I'm trying to do. Invite people with some degree of coincidence with right view. It won't be a complete coincidence unless they're a very, very committed Buddhist. And even, I'm afraid, some Buddhists. Anyway, let's not go there. I mean, they're lovely people, don't get me wrong. I recently had a wonderful conversation. I hope you've watched it on YouTube with Rupert Sheldrake. And we got on like a house on fire. It's very funny. It was a very funny way of laughing. And, you know, the reason I interviewed him, it was in conversation with him, because he's critical of scientism, which is a belief in science, it's not science, it's just an irrational belief that science will answer all human questions, such as, what am I here for, what's the meaning of life? Science is never meant to answer those questions. It can tell you, it should be to do with evidence, you know, that, and actually, if you, one of the things that Rupert does is, you know, lots of people say their dog knows when they're coming home. So he said, well, you should be able to find evidence for that. If it's true, you should be able to do studies. And he's done exhaustive studies on dogs. I could have told him, my dog definitely knew that I was coming home. So really, it should be a provocation to do better science, not against science. It should be, but hang on. People say this, you know, science should come from direct experience, and then you try and work it up. At the same time, Rupert is quite a committed Christian. Now, Christians, if you don't know about Christianity, they believe in God. And, you know, for Buddhism, that's a clear wrong view, yeah? Buddhists don't believe in God. They don't believe in any kind of literally existing supernatural deity. You know, I didn't say, hi, Rupert, great to have you. We don't believe in God. We got into talking about metaphysical materialism, his critique of science and so on. Yeah. So you see, he's got a degree of coincidence with right view, and that's why I wanted to talk to him. And I've invited Helen on exactly the same basis, because that's what excited me so much about reading Cynical Theories, is this, I particularly value that, I think, this sense of, gosh, that's what I want to say. I mean, Helen's been much braver than me. You're a very brave woman, much braver than I am, much more intelligent than I am as well. I'm more like metaphor. but she, for me, the coincidence of right view for me is particularly such things. One of the things she explores in the book, and which we'll talk about today, is that there's no such thing as, the idea that there's no such thing as universal values. Yeah? That values are all kind of locally produced. So this place of these values, these places of those places. There's no way of adjudicating them. Yeah? That if you think that over there, that's you. If you think this over there, that's you. There's no way of saying, but hang on, what's true and what's best? So that becomes an undermining of the idea of universal values. The Buddha, I believe, would say that was the wrong view. He would say, no, there's truth, there's generosity, there's love, you know, there's all of those great things. And if you undermine them and say, well, they're actually cultural constructs, you're actually going to hurt yourself and hurt other people. And in a way, Helen's work really explores that. And the second area that I was particularly struck by is the idea that there's no such thing as objective knowledge. It's interesting that there's now an attack on science from both the right wing and the left wing, that we start to think, well, that's just a sort of narrative, and yeah, very interesting. But you know, there's no such thing as objective knowledge. And Helen will say, as I know, that you know, there's something in that. There are definitely, you know, scientists are people who have got funding and, you know, careers to think about, so that tends to create all sorts of issues. But gradually, you try to do better science, because science shouldn't be a position on something. It should be to do with testing things. Okay, that's what you say. Let's see if that's true. That's what science is. It's not a dogma. Yeah? It's not a doctrine. It's a method. So that's my rather long way of saying, you know, why I've asked Helen to see us. So Helen, I thought we'd start, you know, let's start, you know, right from the start, and start with what you're not saying in critical theory. You know, we could write another book about all the things you're not saying, yes. And I know that you're drawn to have to do that a lot, but you're not saying that there isn't intolerance, oppression, and injustice. You're not saying they don't exist, and you're not saying they don't exist in relationship to race, sexual orientation, or gender. So perhaps let's start with saying, you sort of having to reiterate what you're not saying.
Yes, yeah, so I...
Weird place to start.
I do have to do my disclaimers. Yes, because I have been very critical of what we now call critical social justice, or colloquially called the woke movement. People will often believe that I am critical of their aims, which is not the case. The aim to see and address racism, sexism, homophobia, other forms of prejudice is very important. I don't think critical social justice does it very well, because it's going through a very fine theoretical lens. It's not relying on empirical research. It's not inclusive of a wider range of views that can be held by anybody from any group. So I have, in my last book, that people often refer to me as anti-woke, but I would prefer a liberal proponent of social justice who is critical of critical approaches to social justice, but still wants everybody to be able to have their own views and express them, as long as they don't impose them on anybody else.
Let's have that again, because I think you can see why they just said anti-woke.
Yes.
but it, you know, woke has become a kind of term of abuse, hasn't it? So I can.
Be applied to absolutely everything now. I am pro-liberal, I am pro-humanist, and there I think I do overlap with the Buddhist worldview, with the universal humanism. And so we come at issues of social justice from this perspective. We are we exist on three levels. We are all individuals, and we have our own minds. We are all members of various groups, demographics either produced naturally or culturally, and we are all members of the human race, with much more in common than we have differences. So I think that any approach to social justice needs to take into account those three levels. Liberalism in some cases can be naive. It can focus on the individual and the universal and miss out the middle bits. Now, with critical social justice has focused on those middle groups, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man, what it means to be black, what it means to be white, and tried to attach all these beliefs and values and knowledge to it as the one authentic voice of a certain group. And by doing that, it has excluded probably most of the voices of every group. It has produced quite a reductionist, simplistic model, which really hasn't worked very well, and we can see that it hasn't worked very well where it has been introduced in policy.
So I'm going to have to keep on sort of getting you to explain things, but I think it'd be good to explain what we mean by liberal, because in the US it means, I still haven't quite got clear what it means in the US, to be honest. I'm not great on that sort of thing, but it's become a term that's sometimes used in all sorts of ways. It'd be good to get, what do you mean? What is liberal, and where does liberal come from?
Yeah, so liberal is sometimes misunderstood or misused to mean on the left, or it can sometimes be understood to mean a very sort of licentious, anything goes. Right. But liberalism at its root is the principles that have underlie liberal democracies, the shift that happened slowly over the modern period, in which we came to accept the view that you let people believe, speak and live as they see fit, provided it does not do any material harm to anyone else, nor denies them the same freedom. And then we are positively inclined towards the free exchange of ideas for the production of knowledge and for individual liberty.
Mm. And the free, let's just even dwell a bit on this free production of ideas. You talk in the book about the marketplace of ideas. It'd be good to just, again, and partly because these conversations go so far sometimes, especially in the digital world. So say a bit more about the marketplace of ideas. Why is that essential for liberalism?
So prior to our liberal phase, of course, and I believe that this is really the natural human state of being around the world and throughout history, is that one group of humans have gained influence and power and then been able to tell everybody else what they must believe, what they must say, how they must live. And this has produced factionalism and fighting. We've had dynasties, monarchies, theocracies imposing on people until knocked aside by another one. Liberalism and the marketplace of ideas is very much about coexistence. There's an overarching value where you don't have to affirm anybody else's ideas. You don't have to compromise with anybody else's ideas. You have to coexist with them unless they are actually doing you harm. And this understanding that people must be able to express their views, that they must be able to enter into robust debate about them if they so choose, nobody has to, has been extremely productive. We have seen that over the modern period, as people have been able to argue for things, ask whatever questions they want, and there's always limits on liberalism, but more than they had done before, we have seen scientific knowledge advance hugely. We have seen human rights move on, advance greatly as well. So the values underlying this liberal democracy, this belief that I do not have to agree with what you say, but you must be able to say it, that knowledge is produced by the conflict of these ideas. We discover what is wrong that way, has produced really astonishingly fast advances in knowledge and in human rights.
And even bad ideas are part of that, aren't they?
With that's how we find that they are bad. Right. So I have argued, for example, that I believe France is wrong to make it illegal to say that the Holocaust didn't happen. Of course the Holocaust happened. The people who say that it didn't are generally ill-motivated to say so. However, as soon as that belief arises, then we have to address it, because if people cannot say things, then other people cannot counter them. This belief becomes the truth that they don't want you to know. And it gains power, whereas if we keep as many ideas as we can in the mainstream and argue with them as they arise, that is the way to be less wrong.
Right, yeah. See, I think that's very important, that you know, you're trying to get to the truth, and of course that implies that there is such a thing, but you're trying also, I was very struck by that listening to one of your podcasts, and you know, how the whole question of the Holocaust, because presumably people said it didn't exist. Absurd thing, but then of course you then have to go and say, what evidence do they have for that belief, and then you find the opposite evidence.
We must always have, wonderful new book is called The Certainty Trap by Alana Redstone, and she's keeping the door of hold your beliefs with confidence if they are warranted, but keep the door slightly open, because you could actually be wrong. We could actually be wrong about anything at all, and if somebody discovers a truth that is not known, we need to remain open to that. We need to give them the opportunity to show their evidence, make their argument, and become less wrong.
And that is difficult to do, isn't it? Because you know, sort of difficult to, you know, have the courage to do that and to feel that will be met. You know, I suppose is perhaps one of the concerns. You know, if I bring out a difficult thought that you might not like, or someone might not like, that, you know, it's difficult to do that. You know, how can we, do you think that's part of it?
I don't know. I think that there's a very natural instinct to say, well, if these ideas are horrible, why should we allow them to be expressed? Yeah. You know, we struggle a lot, I think, to think that if I allow this idea to be spoken and to exist, then I am somehow endorsing it.
Yes, that seems to be one of it, yeah.
The right moral thing to do is to try to stamp it out. Mm. But, of course, that doesn't work. We've seen this recently with the critical social justice movement that has tried to ban all kinds of ideas, and what's happened is alternative spaces. I call these alternative marketplaces of ideas. Mm. And sometimes when the ideas are really horrible, then they're dark markets of ideas, and they get twisted, and they feed into each other because nobody is challenging them. People aren't talking to each other. Mm. They get very dark and dangerous, and they can gain power. And then they can do a great deal of harm.
Mm. Well, that's really valuable. Just carrying on at the moment with what you're not saying, we will get on to
that. I shall try to keep my answers a bit more concise.
No, you're conciser than I am. You know, we will get to what you are saying. But I suppose I'm trying to sort of think, okay, how would this look if I'm into critical theory or social justice? I suppose one of the fears I might have is, okay, look, you're right, but you know, if we criticise critical theory and social justice, especially at a time where queer people, people of colour, trans people feel increasingly under threat, you know, if I'm non-binary, if I'm, you know, I could say, well, I'm sure you mean well, you know, I'm sure you're a nice person, but this will just make things worse. You know, because we need to hang on to this theory, and you might have goodwill, but you're basically opening the door to more discrimination. That would be, I think, my argument. You know, that yeah, okay, you mean well. I don't doubt that. I'm doing it as best as I can. You're doing it as best as you can, but we're in difficult times, darling. I possibly wouldn't say darling. but we're in difficult times, you know, the world is a darker place. We really just can't do it. I'm sorry, this isn't the time. I would imagine is the argument. How would you respond, as it were, to me in that argument?
I see that there is a reasoning error that has happened here, in which people often think that allowing certain ideas to exist and be spoken is a kind of middle ground that doesn't work to get rid of bad ideas. And when ideas are really terrible and when it's really urgent, you haven't got time for this. You haven't got time for reasoned debate and discussion. You just have to squash it out. Yeah. But this relies on the assumption that ideas can be squashed out by suppressing them more quickly than they can be by arguing with them. Mm-hmm. And that is not supported by the evidence. Mm-hmm. As we've seen Greg Lukianoff's look at how Nazism managed to gain hold, showed that it was very much escalated by banning all the newspapers associated with it, banning the groups, forcing them into underground, and allowing them to have a kind of populist revolution.
So banning the stuff, the Nazi stuff, pre-Nazi, is that right?
Yes, and you also then you only get certain voices from those groups. Because there is this idea again that there are certain authentic voices, yeah. But when you look into the views of almost any group, you find that most of them are actually much more compatible with liberalism than with critical social justice. We need to remember that the CSJ movement, as I call it, is very much a product of Western thinking. It is not going to automatically be the way, particularly that black and brown Brits think, that they are not automatically going to be critical social justice activists. Yeah. This is as particularly on the race issue, it has developed in an American context. Now, black Americans nearly all are very much Western. They've ancestors sort of traced back longer than white Americans, most of them. In this country, black and brown Brits have usually arrived within the last three generations from a country which is actually more conservative on the issues of sexuality and gender, on issues of religion. And so I find that this is particularly problematic when you're trying to say, well, this is the authentic voice of colour, and it's very, very left-wing, identitarian queer theory and all of these other things, when it generally that's not the voice of any identity group at all. It can be the voice of some members in it, and we must make sure those members are included. Mm. But it is not helpful to say, well, these are your views and I'm protecting them on your behalf. Mm. When you're really then just going to deny intellectual diversity to the groups that you most want to protect.
Mm. Mm. I suppose the other thing is then, but because it's interesting, the instinct can be on any side to squash the view. Can't say that, you know, we haven't got time. That's just dangerous. It's got to be obliterated. You're saying that actually getting into discussion and is better. The danger of that, of course, is it seems slow, and often problematic, isn't it? It's not that liberalism is always nice people sitting around and thinking what's best for everyone. Mm-hmm. Presumably.
Well, no, I mean, the discussions that go back and forth, but this is, I would say, the very best way, the very quickest way to discredit bad ideas is to have bad actors expressing them. Right. Otherwise, if you are trying to convey them as they are and just, well, these are all terrible and we do need to shove them aside, well, people then start getting curious about this. Well, what do they really think? And then they become vulnerable to being sucked into this. I am very, very concerned at the moment about the anti-woke, anti-DEI policies coming from the Trump administration. Mm. My fear is, particularly in universities, that they are now squashing out all of these critical social justice ideas. We are seeing universities just removing them. There are over 200 words that are associated with DEI, which are now not allowed to be expressed.
What's DEI again?
Diversity, equity, and inclusion, mm. which is the practical approach to critical social justice ideas, mm. which really does put everybody in certain groups with certain beliefs. Mm. And it's not very helpful. But while squashing these out, then we must not express these. My fear is that what he's doing, particularly in the university setting, is driving them into hiding. He is preventing academics and other people from actually getting at them. If we wanted to show these ideas not to work, not to be helpful, not to represent the people they say they do, we could really have done with this 4 years to actually be able to discuss that. But what Trump is doing at the moment is pushing them into hiding. People are just changing words and overtly saying, well, I'm just going to bunker down for 4 years and teach something else. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, sympathy is rising for these ideas in other places, in alternative spaces. And my fear is that we're going to see in 4 years a massive backlash, mm-hmm. which will knock the Trump administration out of place. In the meantime, these critical social justice ideas are going to have gained sympathy, going to have gained strength, and they're going to smash back and knock out freedom of speech from that side. And so we're going to have a constant pendulum swing, where what we need to do is stop that pendulum from swinging, have people talk to each other. And I think then that the evidence would discredit most of the critical social justice ideas, but not all of them. Right. Some of them have value and they need to be developed.
I mean, it's interesting because in the book, in a moment I'm going to get onto what you're saying. In the book, you know, you're saying, look, there is, you know, where the critical race theory, queer theory, the other theories, you know, you abbreviate into theory, which is helpful, I think. You say, look, there is a kernel of truth in nearly all of them, but they've been ballooned out of, it seems to me they've become ballooned into a dogma, which is different from, look, here's something that is a genuine concern.
Yes, I think there's a kernel of truth in everything, and then the critical theories seem to just take them off in the wrong direction. Mm. So the truth, for example, in queer theory is that we have put people into categories, we have policed them, we have said you have to be a feminine woman attracted to men and you have to be a masculine man attracted to women. And by putting people into these categories, we made a lot of people very miserable and lonely and not able to do this. So then they go way off course and say, well, we need to break down all of these categories now. Absolutely everything is a social construct. Mm. And that then removes the categories that do actually exist and that people do need to exist. The concept of homosexual disappears at this point. The concepts of masculine, of feminine, of gender non-conforming, and then we have a mess where people are then trying to say, well, this is who I am, this is who I love. And there isn't a framework for that. There isn't a way for them to express that. And so we see people then being told that they sort of politically have to be attracted to certain other people. They politically have to present in a certain way. And it was incredibly counterproductive, whereas the liberal approach of you are who you say you are, you live as you see fit, providing you're not hurting anyone else, the rest of us, we just accept you as you are.
Yeah.
And we support the outliers, the people who don't fit into that framework.
Well, there was that slogan, wasn't there? Some people are gay, get over it.
Yes, I always argue that was the perfect slogan. That was the one. Look, is this doing you any harm at all? Right, get over it. Then stop. But then when we've moved into we're queer, we're here. We're not going shopping.
Which is absolutely not the case, I tell you. The first two were right, but the not going shopping were way off, I tell you.
Then we're kind of we're into a thing where we then are kind of imposing on other people. There's you have to now accept these beliefs. You can't just accept me as I am and respect my self-determination. You now have to believe all these strange things, and if you don't, you're a terrible person.
So let's now get on to something. You're saying the more things that you're saying. So let's go. I want to talk about your four themes that you write about in the book. And well, you know, in the time given to us, we can only.
I shall get more concise. I promise.
No, you're doing very, you're very very concise. So the first one I want to go to is actually the last in your list, which is you talk about the loss of the individual and the universal. You've already said actually that. And, you know, to take a social justice position is to argue for that middle band, which is, you know, there are groups. Because, you know, I was thinking about this, you know, I am myself gay, I suppose, although it's of only logical value now, you know. I actually publicly retired from being gay, but anyway. I actually publicly said I'd like to hand it in now, thanks. Not as an activity, just as an identification, you know. But, you know... you can overdo it, especially as you get older. You know what I mean. I was literally the only gay in the village. I did find it, fairly agonising, really quite agonising. It was a sort of torture. And you know, coming to, you know, part of the reason I moved to London was so that I said it was to go to art school, which is ostensibly it was, but it was really to meet other men, you know, because you weren't going to meet them in Henley and Arden, I can tell you. You know, and so there is a value, isn't there? In, you know, for me, there was definitely a value, not now so much, actually, but there was a value at a time of, you know, being gay. I have a friend of mine shared a photograph of me on Gay Pride, you know, when I was considerably younger and better looking. I wish I'd realised that at the time. So there is a value in it up to a point, isn't there?
I think so, yeah. I think the best book I've ever read on this is Armin Malouf's On Identity. And he addresses that. It's when there is a part of us that is under threat, that part tends to then come to the forefront. And he uses that example and he says that, yes, when homosexuality was criminalised, when there was a lot of bullying and hostility, then it became very important to gay men particularly to say, I am gay and I am here. And you need to let me live as I wish to. I'm not doing you any harm. But then as this died down and there were threats to a country, he was speaking at that time about Italy, then the identity as a gay man receded and a nationalist identity is then coming out because it depends very much what is being threatened. If you are being threatened for your Christian faith, then a lot of people will then suddenly really make this a very much a central part of their identity if they had not done so before, if it's a cultural belief more than a religious one. So yes, that element, it is useful and it has been useful for women to as well to say, look, we we can't get mortgages out in our own name. We're not getting paid the same amount. This is because we are women. We need to organise as women for people of racial minority to say that there is explicit racial discrimination going on here. I am not being treated as an individual. I am not being given access to everything. This is both immoral and extremely counterproductive to producing a society that flourishes well. Mm. So then you have to have what is often called identity politics, but I don't think it is, really, because it's an aim for, if you can imagine a graph with all of the rights and freedoms up there, and then all of the different groups, and then you just look behind this 100% thing and see who isn't reaching that. And historically, that has been black people, brown people, women, gay people, trans people are being discriminated against. And there are then things we can do about that. But the aim is to get them up to this universal stage and then we stop.
Right. Yeah. That's very, 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 very good. So can you then say a bit? That's this middle band that, because you know, it's not part of that thought, and you know, I wanted to make sure that you know everyone heard about that middle band. This question of the loss of the individual and the loss of the universal for Buddhism is very much a concern. Buddhism is emphatic. It's actually radically individual. Not individualist. I mean, my own teacher, Sangharakshita, is very uneasy about individualism. But, you know, an absolute tenet of Buddhism is that you need to decide yourself. You know, the Pali word is ahipassika, which means come and try it for yourself. So it's not through authority. It's not because of holy writ. You know, even the Buddha, someone would say, how do I know what's true? Do I just do what you tell me? And he said, well, you try it for yourself. You know, if you hear such a thing, if it conduces to dispassion rather than passion, by which you mean, you know, non-hatred rather than hatred, if it conduces to generosity rather than meaning, well, that's fine. You know, that was his criteria in a way. So it's very much about the individual, but it's also very much saying, and we are all in the same boat. We are all there, you know, there is dukkha, suffering. We all suffer. The Buddha said that I teach suffering and the end of suffering. And by that, I think he's also saying, I've not got a theory about life. I haven't got, there's no Buddhist word that translates as philosophy, interestingly. He's just saying, we human beings suffer. We all suffer as a universal thing. We suffer in all kinds of ways. I'm concerned with that fact. I'm concerned with the individual and universal human suffering and lessening universal human suffering. Where Buddhism goes further is to say, actually, do you know what? That sense you have of being a self is itself causing you suffering. Now, we might not want to go that far just in our conversation. But so this idea of the individual, and you know, Buddhism is emphatic about taking full personal responsibility for yourself, is actually utterly unforgiving about that. You know, in some suttas it says, look, even if people are reviling you and hatefully treating you, if you act negatively towards them, well, that's your problem. You know, it's very unforgiving in that way. It won't let you blame anyone. You know, it's very, very high ideal to live up to, even in a small way. But there's no way you can blame people in Buddhism. You can't blame yourself. You can't blame white people, black people, men, women. You can't blame anyone. You have to take responsibility.
Well, that is very interesting then, because the criticism that came from the postmodern school of thought is that this idea of an individual operating within a wider status as a human with common experiences with other humans is a product of white Western male modernity, that when people speak of being an individual, when they speak of common humanity, what has actually happened is that straight white men have decided what common humanity is and then imposed it on everybody else. And we actually need to deconstruct that and bring out the stories, the voices, the experiences of those groups who have not been heard. Of course, there is, again, a kernel of truth in there. But when it wipes out individuality almost entirely, And it sees people as products of their identity group and their socialization. This is often referred to as positionality, where you are placed within these power structures that will decide how you think. It's very dehumanizing.
So, say more about what that, because I've never quite got my head around positionality.
Yes.
What are those words that you hear? You think, yeah, what's that again?
So within these theories, the second wave really from the 90s of identity-based theories, we are all socialized into acceptance of certain systems of power and privilege. They are white supremacist, they are masculinist, they are imperialist, they are cis-heteronormative, and which means assuming that everybody is straight, assuming everybody identifies as the gender that matches their biological sex. And then we see the world from our position there. So you as a gay man will see things that I don't, because I am mostly heterosexual and am female.
I'm mostly gay as well. I've got a bit of the other bit.
But I will see things that you don't, because you're a man, so you won't need to see the oppression that women face. I will see it.
Yeah.
So in positionality statements, in essays, it will say, well, I must acknowledge my privilege as a white cisgender woman, and I'm also speaking from my knowledge as being a woman, being fat, being disabled. And so I have knowledge from those three things that thin men, thin able-bodied men don't, so I have authority there, but I would need to hear from people of colour and trans people where I am lacking in knowledge. Now, again, there's a truth in this experience. If you want to know what somebody is experiencing, then you ask the people who are experiencing it. But the idea that this is directly tapped into knowledge, and that you have a positionality where you can see some things and not see other things, that you can only reason from your own status, that this then gets into very, very confused arguments where people are saying, well, you're not allowed to have an opinion on this because you're a man. You mustn't speak on that because you are white. And then we have people who aren't men and who aren't white and who aren't who are trans or gay or things, saying, well, actually, I don't believe in this this thing that you're attributing to me. I'm an individual, and nope, you have been socialized into these things. Your self. You've got a self-hatred thing going on, or you'd agree with us. What?
Right, yeah.
What?
I mean, it's odd, isn't it? Because it seems so absolutely fundamental that there's something irreducible about oneself. You know, that our self-sense seems to me to go off into something ineffable. You know, you never quite know who you are, but it feels irreducible. I'm not a category, you know. Nobody is a category, and to treat them as a category always feels like it's a destruction of their humanity, not a development of it. I don't know whether I'm right there.
I feel very much this way from my liberal humanist perspective. I feel very much this way. I feel that it undermines the dignity and the autonomy of a person to understand them as a collection of categories, and then believe you can design their views from that. It reduces, it removes their individuality, and it removes us all from understanding each other.
And you see, from a Buddhist perspective, this matter of individuality is so important. And you could argue that Buddhism is, first of all, trying to develop that, so it's a more and more healthy, mature individuality that can think, that can feel other people. But then what about this, the denial of the universal? Because again, you know, I think for me, one of my strongest experiences in the Buddhist community that I'm part of is having friends that I would, you know, if I'd stayed in Henley and Arden, I just would never have met them. You know, completely different to me. I'm actually really, I mean this in no offence, but I'm really pleased not to be in a gay enclave, you know, with some of my friends have ended up being, you know, I remember going to a gay bed and breakfast and they said, this is 100% gay. Don't worry, it's 100%. You want to say, what, the carpets are gay? You know, like, I don't need the carpets to be gay. I just need it to be not a problem. You know, I don't, you know, the clouds going overhead are gay. You know, apparently it was all gay. 100%, absolutely 100%.
It is quite reductionist and patronising, isn't it?
Nuts, you know. But what about this sort of undermining of the universal? Because this sense of us being here together and this being human is not an easy matter for anyone, whether they've got money or not money, it's mostly harder for people if they haven't, although that's weirdly not brought into the discussion, the whole
question. No, that would be
question.
Very inconvenient if you went with the class aspect.
Yeah, it's very odd, isn't it, how that's dropped out. You know, I thought that was that's a massive issue. Like, I remember walking recently to a cinema with a friend, just walking up to Hackney here, and, you know, lovely summer night, walking around, saying, nah, cha cha cha, you know, going to have a coffee. And I suddenly had this thought, all of this is closed if you haven't got money. You haven't, it is closed to you. We don't want you. You know, if you haven't got money, it's closed, you know. So, you know, there's that that hasn't, seems to me, to be brought into the discussion. But say how we've got to try to dissolve the universal, because that, from a Buddhist point of view, that seems to me to be, you know, thoroughly wrong view.
Well, I think with what was often called the liberal humanist movement within modernism, within literature, there was, I will steel man the criticism, because there was a tendency for white public schoolboys to declare the universal experience to be theirs.
And
put that out there. So this has then kind of been brought to an extreme where anybody claiming to have a sense of shared humanity, that there is universal human experience, is then understood to have bought into this socialisation of Western liberalism, which is actually universalising the straight white male experience. So it isn't really wanting to say that we don't have everything, a great deal in common. It's wanting to say that what we have understood as having in common is actually been designed for us by straight white men, so we need to deconstruct that and look at that. So that's the best case that you can make for it. But in practice, of course, it has broken down to people having really sort of their own field of knowledge, and you just have to accept this lived experience of this group as long as it matches what is theorised by critical social justice. If it doesn't, then they are either blind or pandering to the majority. And that has caused an enormous amount of divisions, of course, which is a really terrible idea for a species of tribal territorial apes, to tell them that they all belong in certain little groups and that they are in competition with each other for resources. I don't know why anybody thought that was a good idea. So that is the problem. And I, as a liberal humanist, I would argue, well, no, I can read something that was written in 6th century China, as long as it is translated for me, and I can fairly accurately sort of empathise with the character here, but what they are going through. I do not have to be a 6th century Chinese woman in order to do that. And I think by closing that down, when you can't say, well, I have not experienced what you have, but I can empathise and imagine that this made you feel very lonely, very frightened. That is how I would feel. Is that how you feel? Then I think that is the level of shared human experience. And we can listen then, and we can understand, and we can relate things to our own lives. As soon as we stop doing that, then we are starting to see other people as less human.
Yeah. See, it's interesting because one of the great things about diversity is it enriches you so much. You know, as I say, I come from this small town where everybody was white. Everyone, was sort of Church of England. And, you know, I moved here to art school and went to Britain and lived in Brixton. I loved it. You know, I remember buying a plantain for the first time. I've finally become this sort of groovy guy. I actually didn't know what to do with it. But anyway, diversity kind of empathy across difference really enriches you. So it's really odd that. Can you give any example of how that gets closed down? Because it's almost, I suppose the argument could be, I'm trying to steal men things or steal women things as well, which is, you know, the argument would be, well, actually, you know, that's exaggerating, you know, that doesn't get closed down, you know. The fear can be that all these are just exaggerated claims, that, you know, social justice is very concerned with the universal and empathy across difference and so on. Can you sort of help us see that that might not be the case?
Well, the most sort of clear example of this would be, again, in academic papers and in sort of classroom settings, wherever we have a really very strong critical social justice element, particularly the work of Robin DiAngelo. If we take that is taught to teachers on a really very basic level, and then brought into classrooms. And one of her tenets is that you, as a white person, if a black person tells you that you have said something wrong or insulting, you do not need to understand that. You cannot understand that. You have to accept the feedback and try not to do it again. And this, again, it assumes that there is a consensus here. It isn't this one individual who has said, well, I perceive you're complimenting my hair as racist, is actually sort of attached to one ideology, whereas another black woman would say, oh, thank you, yes. So we've got this now. It is then shutting it down, and we get those positionality statements where someone will say, I know that I cannot speak to this, and this, and so I will only speak from there, and I will try to do humility, and I will thank anybody of queer identity or person of colour who educates me, but recognise that you do not have the responsibility to do so. And then we're tying ourselves in knots, trying not to assume anything, trying to recognise the gaps in our own knowledge, and people are just getting further and further apart. We see now in companies that have had these kinds of trainings for more than 5 years, they end up the most dramatic differences, that they have 9% fewer black women in positions of management. And this is because constantly dividing people into different groups makes people think that everybody was much more racist than they originally thought they were. They make people who actually were racist think, well, they're saying everybody is. This is normal. I'm not going to feel guilty about this and actually be more racist. And then people don't see each other as people anymore. It becomes very uncomfortable, and it becomes most uncomfortable for women, who are on average less, more conflict averse, and for people of racial minority who are a minority. And so they start dropping out, and it was actually much, much better if you had a standard anti-discrimination policy, which is don't be racist, sexist or homophobic, or we'll kick you out, because that is horrible.
Yeah, indeed. So listen, I want to say more, I want us to talk more about that in a minute, but I think it's a good time for a cup of tea.
Yes, always a good time to have a cup of tea.
So let's have a cup of tea, and then we'll carry on talking together. So I wanted to just backtrack for a moment before we go. We'll keep going on with your four themes. But yeah, when we were talking just there, I'm going to say I realise this, but Yonah Vocha told me that I'm mixing up forms of it. So I'm talking about social justice and you're talking about critical social justice. And I think that's in it, and I've got that wrong, because I think that that's one of the issues, I think, is that and I know you do, that the capitals are problematic. That you know, because social justice, like, who fairly would ever disagree with social justice? So let's just do a bit of clarification of terms, because I'm mixing that up. I'm saying social justice as if that's an issue, a problem, and you're saying critical social justice. So I thought I'd ask you to clarify that, because I've made it a bit unclear, I think.
Well, this is one of the problems I have with the movement, with other kinds of thought. You know, that Marxism is based on the thought of Marx. Conservatism is about conserving things. Liberalism is about freedom. But the social justice movement is essentially calling itself, you know, good things. Because, as you said, nobody really said, I want less justice in society. No, we all want a just society. We disagree about how to achieve that. And the problem with the social justice movement is that it takes on these names, and then in order to disagree with them, you end up appearing to be against social justice, appearing to be pro-fascism, if you're not supporting Antifa, and not to think that Black Lives Matter, if you're not on board with all of the principles of that movement. So I think we need to come away from that. And critical social justice is what Özlem Sensoy and Robin DiAngelo called it, when they distinguished it from the general aim for social justice and said this is a precise theoretical approach to social justice, which comes from the critical tradition, capital C, which started in Marxist thought, but has gone down right through the idea of critical consciousness, that you become aware of systems of social injustice, that you are deconstructing society for these particular power systems. And so critical social justice, or CSJ, is something I've been trying to make happen. I'm probably going to admit defeat and just call it woke, because that is what we see, is people believing themselves to be awakened to certain systems of power and privilege.
I think that's important, because, you know, social justice without capitals is, you know, the history of liberalism has been an incredible history of social justice, you know, decriminalizing homosexuality. Was it the Dutch court that started with gay marriages, and that you could get gay men could get divorced, and lesbians could get divorced, and you could adopt? I remember that happening, and then I think something like 34 countries now, something more than that, you know, have such things. So social justice without the capitals is something that human beings have been concerned with since at least the Reformation, and probably before that.
If you look at Greek philosophy, you see Romans, that there's always a drive. How do we live a good life among other people, is speaking of social justice.
So I just thought it'd be good to sort of clarify that. So, you know, we're still on this first theme of denying the individual, denying the universal, and this question of critical social justice as a theoretical tool, really, not a description of what happens when people fair-mindedly try and improve things. One of the central laws of Buddhism, and we'll come to other aspects of Buddhism perhaps later. Perhaps you didn't expect me to talk about Buddhism quite so much, but we are in a Buddhist center, so it's not like weird, is it? So one of the central laws of Buddhism, found in the Dhammapada, which is, you know, one of the strongest canonical texts, you know, that we have, reportedly from things that the Buddha said at various times. He said, hatred is never overcome by hatred. Hatred is only ever overcome by love, and this is a universal law. So hatred is never overcome by hatred. It is only overcome by love, and that's a universal law. So one of the things that I've been most perturbed about, you know, critical social justice, is how much hatred there seems to be, at least how much anger. I can see that people feel hurt, and I can see that people feel threatened, and I've been there myself. You know, if I imagine myself back at 16 at high school, being called very horrible names, you know, it was very, very painful and you know, nightmarish. But I'm very concerned with that anger and hatred. I wonder, A, do you think I'm right by saying there does seem to be a lot of anger and hatred? And why has it got like that? Why is it not just, okay, you know, here's what I'm trying to say. You know, there must be good ways of putting things, wasn't there? Because as you say, there's kernels of truth in so many of these things.
I think the real, the sort of visceral anger and the wish to punish others for not thinking the same way is very much a trait of zealots rather than of the critical social justice movement itself. So we're seeing a lot of very similar behaviour at the moment coming from the far right, which has always existed, of course, but now it's there's this idea of a woke right, because they're doing that same, trying to cancel people, trying to punish the speech, really being very malicious and taking glee in the downfall of others, which is very, very ugly and horrible.
Can you just say a bit more? Because I was talking to a friend about the woke right, and he said, what could that possibly be? What is it?
When we're sort of talking about the problems with woke, we're talking a lot about cancel culture, this idea that you must not believe this, you must not speak like this, that if you do say certain things, then you should be fired from your job. There should be social media pylons. Sense of oneself as at the bottom of these systematic prejudice and sort of imposition of power. And we're seeing this coming very much from the illiberal right at the moment. So we get that a lot in with the Christian nationalists in the US, who are saying very sort of self victimizing things like, why is it that only white nations are not allowed to have their own homeland? And they're speaking as though there is this worldwide system that has said, okay, everybody except white people can have their own homeland, and you are at the bottom of this chain, and you're being oppressed, and you're being put upon, when of course the reality is that anybody can live anywhere apart from Liberia if they just apply correctly and have something to offer. But we have people coming here because there are opportunities here, but they have built this into a conspiratorial narrative in which they are the victims of everybody else.
So the white people become the victims
yes,
of everybody else.
Yes, that's the white identity politics is very much about grievance and victimhood in precisely the same way. And people have said to me, have they learnt this from the woke? And I don't think they have. I think that we are so familiar with this very nasty, you misspoke on that, and I'm going to interpret it this way, and I'm going to make sure you never work again. And then, you know, and the real glee with bashing somebody who has said something perhaps once that was not well advised. And we're seeing that from the right. I've had a lot of it today because I wrote a piece on how adolescence is not making a racial statement of any kind.
Adolescence being that the Netflix program that
yes,
we've been talking about.
I was saying that the people saying that it is anti-white propaganda are actually wanting it to have a racial message, wanting it to be about non-white Brits, mostly Muslims, causing all of the problems, and they're very angry that the boy who committed the murder in this is white. Mm-hmm. And then they're kind of projecting that, saying, well, this is anti-white propaganda because he's white. No, this is your white identity politics reading things through a racial lens that isn't actually there. Mm-hmm. So I have been accused of white genocide and anti-whiteness and not really being white today.
You do something. What? This guy, what's going on here? Everybody calm down. So let's move on to let's move on to your second theme. So your first theme, you know, we've talked about is the sort of denial, the dissolving of the individual and the denial of the universal values, which for Buddhism, those two things are important. We'll come back to that near the end. But then there's this question of cultural relativism is your second theme. So perhaps say what you mean by cultural relativism.
This is a moral relativism and sometimes a knowledge relativism as well, where because everything is understood to be a social construct, it is considered imperialistic to say that the norms in one culture are better than the norms in another, particularly if it's your own. So there is this idea that, say, women in England, if they modesty codes imposed on them, being judged by how they look, how they dress. This is awful. This is patriarchal oppression. But if a Muslim woman is saying the hijab is a sex-based modesty code and it's anti-feminist, then you're not allowed to support her on that, because that would be evaluating one culture from another. It's imperialist, it's colonialist. And also even truth claims. We see this, I'm sort of helping somebody, a Maori woman, with science denialism happening in New Zealand at the moment, because there are beliefs that Maori people just kind of appeared on the land, that there's stories of how that happened, and this is to be seen as a different way of knowing, and it's just as true as the actual history of how people arrived in different ways. And if you say, well, no, objective truth actually does exist, we can trace how this happened. These stories, of course, can have deep meaning, but they're not actually true. Yeah. And then you are then accused of imposing your own culture's understanding of truth.
So that means that you can sort of never say, I suppose, I'm trying to think, what is so dangerous about that, do you think, about cultural relativism?
Well, I think that we have to, and I would say as a liberal, that it is my responsibility to support liberals wherever they are. So I will be in support of the people in the country saying, let's not throw gay men off tall buildings, and not the ones saying, actually, we should do that, because that's the way it is. So I think that what happens then is minorities within minorities gets very much sort of subordinated, and then you get the most conservative and repressive ideas that are held to be the beliefs of this group.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So it's that, you know, that like what we would call like a very cruel idea starts to be, instead of seen as that's cruel, you shouldn't do it, it starts to be, no, you can't say that because you're judging it from another culture.
And that is what a lot of, because I was very involved with the New Atheist movement, and a lot of them were ex-Muslims, and they were trying to say, well, look, women's rights, gay rights, freedom of belief. I could be killed for being an apostate here. This is wrong. But if you try to actually support them in that, then again, because the identity thing, I should not shut up. This is because I am I am white Western imperialist. I think a very, very good example was in the same month that Dia Khan did a programme on honour violence, and she set out 5 steps for addressing it better. It got 480 signatures and was not discussed by Parliament, but another petition to see misogyny as anything that a woman perceives as misogyny got hundreds of thousands. This wasn't because feminists don't care about Muslim women, it was because they felt it's not our place in the intersectional framework. We mustn't say that. And that's a problem, because that really needed to be addressed.
Yeah, and it does seem amazing that one can't address it. And is it, it's almost amazing, because is it because that you'll get thrown back, that you're this is colonialist and so on?
Yes, it will be believed that you are trying to say, well, a sort of white Western liberal culture is so much superior to every other culture. And in some ways, I would like to argue that it is. In other ways, I would like to argue that it isn't. There's a stronger sense of community and family loyalty, for example, say in Pakistan. We don't have this here. We have a lot of elderly people in care homes where they don't need to be, loneliness epidemic among the elderly. Yeah. That doesn't happen in Pakistan. I would say that aspect of that culture is better than ours.
Yes, of course.
But the throwing gay men off tall buildings, not so much.
No. Okay, well, that's perfectly clear. So let's move. We can move on to the power of language. I mean, this is your third theme, the power of language. So, again, I'm kind of wanting to keep on coming back to my own sort of Buddhist view of this. So Buddhist ethics is an ethics of intention. And of course, you can even get that wrong because, you know, you can sort of, I can be horrible to you and say, oh, I didn't mean to do it, it's just silly. You know, what Buddhism means by an ethics of intention is it's what you really mean by what you're doing. So I could give you a gift, and I could give you a gift because I like you and appreciate you, or I could give you a gift so that you like and appreciate me and are nicer to me next time, you know. And Buddhism is saying that your intentions are absolutely crucial. You know, that it's the ethics, it's an ethics of intention. So if I hurt you, you know, I'll apologize for it, but if I didn't intend to, in that deep sense, I don't mean in the trivial sense of, which is really just a double think, that I pretend I didn't, but I did. You know, what I really meant to do. So that's what Buddhist ethics is founded on, yeah? That what I mean by what I do is what's important. Now, the concern for me with this whole, and you'll talk about it, this question of if we then take up this language view that, racism, transphobia, misogyny is baked into my language, whether I'm aware of it or not. So as we're talking, I'm, misogynist in relationship to you, even if I have no intention to be, even if I get things wrong, but actually, sort of, that destroys for me that ethics of intention.
Yes.
You know, and that's very, from a Buddhist point of view, a classic Buddhist point of view, that's very, that would be, again, a Buddhist wrong view. That your intention is what matters. And you can get that wrong, you can say clumsy things. Sometimes I remember a friend of mine saying something that was a bit off colour, I actually liked him better for it because I thought at least he's telling me what he actually thinks, you know, rather than, because you can learn very quickly, can't you, what to say and what not to say. And sometimes you feel that, and you feel that you're being managed rather than communicated with. I wondered whether how you'd respond to that thought, and then what you mean by the power of language, what critical social justice means by that.
Well, I think that distinction between intention and impact, that is very core to the critical social justice movement. They will say intention doesn't matter. It's all about impact. It is, as you say, because it is believed that that you are speaking from this socialised systems of power and privilege, so you will be harming other people. And if somebody says, well, you have just harmed me, then you have to have the humility to accept that. Your own intentions do not matter at all. And of course, we can see a lot of distinctions here. I had a neighbour once who said, I'm not racist, but I don't want them living next door to me. Speaking of South Asian people, I thought, okay, you believe now that your intention was not to be racist, but I'm afraid, objectively, by saying I don't want this brown person living next to me, this is the definition of racism. So in that sense, her intention, lack of intention, was actually a lack of self-awareness, and she can be criticised for that. Yeah. But if somebody says one thing that is apparently a microaggression is complimenting a black speaker, saying, oh, you were so eloquent there. Right. And if the thought is that somebody is surprised that a black speaker is eloquent and articulate, and that speaker could then feel very offended. But if that person said, no, I wish I were as eloquent as you were, I really admire your ability to speak, they should not then be shut down with, no, that was your white supremacy, you're actually surprised. I'm not. So that is the difference. That intention really does matter. Of course it does, because it shows how you're likely to behave in future as well.
So how did we get to thinking that language, because it feels like there's, I was at art school in the 80s, and you couldn't go to art school in the 80s without saying Foucault. Nobody had read the man, but good morning, Foucault, thank you, Derrida, was basically what we said, but nobody actually knew what he meant. How do we get to this idea that language is itself? I mean, I suppose that's one question. How do we get to how language is itself being like that, like this power structure? But how do we get to the idea that language, if I compliment a black speaker, I've actually hurt them. You know, that if I say something like that, how do we get there, I wonder?
Well, I think that this became, of course, this started in the 60s, even earlier with Barthes, in the death of the author. It's all about interpretation. But this has really gained strength from the 80s and 90s, and this was because most of the legal battles had then been won. So then what remained was to challenge societal attitudes. And these really are discernible in the way that we speak. But because of the belief that the powerful in society get to decide what is true, they are the authority then, the way they speak is then taken as truth, and other people speak into those patterns. And of course we know this is true. If you read books from a couple of hundred years ago, you'll see things that are really quite shocking right now. But the idea is that discourses arise, and this is how we know things. There are ways of speaking about certain issues, and they control how we think about those issues. They have been decided by the people in power, and so we need to deconstruct them. People continue to be oppressed by the way that we are speaking about them, about reality. And so we need to look very closely at speech. We need to say this speech cannot be allowed. You need to phrase things this way, and then the social reality will change, and the oppression will lift. But of course, it has become very it's very, very subjective, and it's often quite ridiculous when things like master bedroom are considered to be remnants of slavery. And so it then becomes really kind of language policing that isn't at all helpful and doesn't represent what's in people's minds a lot of the time.
Is there more to say about that? I think there must be. Let me see my notes. What have I said? Because how does it become a kind of violence? We used to say sticks and stones will hurt my bones, but words will never hurt me. we seem to be saying, we seem to have forgotten about sticks and stones, because most people, that is their real harm. And we seem to be very much focusing on words will hurt me. And I know they can. I'm not suggesting that if people say horrible things to me that I'm not hurt by that. But it is a metaphor. I wonder whether, how did we get to how I talk will hurt, literally harm you, if you see what I mean?
I think you really have to try and visualise these systems of power and privilege that are running through everybody. You have been born into this society. You kind of passively absorb all this really oppressive ideas, and then the way that you speak is just constantly maintaining these power imbalances, and that really is it's harming women. We talk in ways that make women irrational and less intelligent and less capable adults. We're talking in ways that make gay people dirty contaminants in society, and we're talking about black people as unintelligent or criminally inclined. And then I think as well there is a kind of competitiveness here, because the belief is that we can't see these systems of power and privilege. Yeah. There is status in being able to detect it. To pick up this phrase, nobody's thought about this before, but I have identified this phrase as part of that oppressive discourse, and that's a kind of moral virtue signalling thing that happens there. And then people compete with each other to problematise each other's words, and then we get into this spiral of language. Language policing, and this has happened at various times in history. It's the idea that language really can be dangerous. Like we see that, of course, in Christian history with heresy and blasphemy laws, and that is believed that you could then corrupt somebody else's faith, and you could lead them to lose their faith, and they could then end up damned for eternity. So language really does have that power, and this is more of a kind of secular version of that.
Again, my concern particularly is that thing that it dissolves this sense of the ethics of intention, which can be appealed to, can't it? I was very struck by Martin Luther King saying, he has a dream that one day his children will be able to be employed without any reference to the colour of their skin. That's what he meant by colour blindness, that they would, you just thought, can they do the job or not? That's an appeal to, and I think one of the reason why that's so powerful and that you argue is that it appeals to human sense of justice and fairness. Even people who are on that racist spectrum will say, good people will say, yes, you shouldn't do that. So you're taking away something that's actually there would help,
Yes, absolutely. You're getting in the way of communication, of that kind of universal experience. That speech of Dr. King's has become so powerful because it spoke to a very common drive that people want their children to succeed. It said to people, look, you have these liberal ideals, you're not living up to them entirely. You would like your children to be judged by the contents of their character, wouldn't you? Well, so do I. And that is why that was so powerful, because it was appealing as one human to another to that drive to wish the best for your own children. And I have compared that with Robin DiAngelo's kind of statements of we need to try to be less white. To be less white is to be less oppressive, less ignorant, less all of these horrible,
horrible
things.
Yeah,
it's very, very, very divisive, obviously an overused term, but that is what it is. We're not sharing the same views now. We're not sharing the same experiences. Whereas the best, I think, comes from humans, when we can say, well, I would not like to be in that situation that you are in, and I have a responsibility to do what I can to help you not be in that situation. It's unjust.
Yeah. Which is, as you said, a strong liberal principle.
Yes, and I think more broadly, more humanist, which I think the universalist thing is very much compatible with the Buddhist idea that we can empathise with others.
Well, one of the great questions is how do we live with each other, isn't it? How do we live in this world together? The capacity to empathise with each other across difference is absolutely crucial for that, and there needs to be give and take across that, doesn't there? There needs to be real give and take. But let's move on to your final thing, and then I want to just talk about one or two other things before we finish. But and this is the other, that your fourth thing. We have done it. I've done it in reverse order than you've done in the book. But the blurring of boundaries. So again, just give you a Buddhist gloss. You know, tolerance is central to Buddhism. You know, Buddhism is famous for being non-violent. You know, and tolerance is absolutely central to any genuine Buddhist thought or practice. As soon as an individual practitioner or Buddhist is becoming intolerant, they're no longer really a Buddhist, they're just a Buddhist by name. And that tolerance includes tolerance of different viewpoints. You know, my own teacher said that, you know, because someone said to him, should we have a Buddhist country? You know, should we have a Buddhist parliament? You know, and he said, well, really what you need is pluralism. You need a genuine pluralism where, you know, and he said that pluralism means there needs to be a kind of genuine sense of, let people do as they want. You know, you know, it's very traditional in Buddhism. You can't make somebody Buddhist. You can't be born a Buddhist. It's something you have to decide by your own conscience. So he argued that what's really the most Buddhist sort of political system is a plural system. So what we've got now is, and part of that is being able to live with other views that don't agree with your own. And that seems to me to be very important, that, you know, we'll come to an area where we might disagree, I think, at the end, but just to show us that we're not peas in a pod. But say a bit more about this blurring of boundaries and what that means.
Well, that's a problem mostly on the level of knowledge and what is true. So I think the best example of this, it comes from Derrida and is found in Judith Butler, where she has said that the problem within queer theory, that the reason that people have been discriminated against because of their sexuality or because of their gender presentation is because they have not fit into these categories of feminine women attracted to men. And so the solution to that is to break down these categories, then to get rid of the concept of feminine, get rid of the concept of woman, get rid of the concept of heterosexuality, homosexuality. If there aren't boxes that people are expected to fit into, then they cannot be oppressed for not fitting into them. And this also then applies to different ways of knowing. For example, where we would have medicine based on science compared with medicine based on sort of traditional myths within a culture or lived experience or divine revelation, all these different ways of knowing. The idea again is that we have unfairly privileged correspondence with truth and set aside all these other things. We need to now blur those boundaries and have them all up there at the front, so that people aren't discriminated against because they go with one way of knowing over another way of knowing.
So let's look at each of those, because there's something in that thing about getting rid of the boxes, isn't there? You know, like from my point of view, I didn't want to just be in this gay box. You know, I didn't. That doesn't describe me. There's something I quite like. In from one perspective, I quite like the idea of let's just, you know, if you're attracted to men, you're attracted to women. You know, let's not call it anything. But you're not talking at that level, are you?
No, it's more of a level of not being allowed to have those boxes. If you, the idea that everything is socially constructed. So, for example, Butler and others will even argue that heterosexuality is a social construct, that ignoring the fact that we're a sexually reproducing species, and that is probably why the majority of people are attracted to the opposite sex.
Probably, yeah, I guess. A wild theory, but yeah, let's entertain it for a moment.
Yeah, and the liberal stance would be, well some people aren't, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So that is where we would go with this, and we would argue that we do not need to say that that there are not biological realities, that, that some ways of knowing are not better than others, in order to be accepting of people who have different ways or who fit out, who can fall outside those boxes. It's again that some people are gay, get over it thing, rather than sexuality is entirely a construct and it was constructed for heterosexuality in order to discipline and control people. They said, no, we're probably meant to be heterosexual by design, because that's how we have children, and some people just happen not to be, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's funny, I'm finding myself reassuring my heterosexual friends that it's fine to be heterosexual. It's like, no, it's quite common. You know, it used to be quite common, and you know, don't need to worry about it. You could talk about it with your friends if you need to, but yeah. You know, it's like, it didn't go out in 1990, you know. But let's go again about this thing of knowledge, because the fear there for me, and perhaps I'm over-egging this, is the danger of over-subjectivity. There is a place for subjectivity, isn't there? Science arguably has left out elements of experience. You know, the argument often is that it's not holistic enough, looks merely at the, you know, it from one lens. But yes, you could say a bit more about this sort of question of knowledge, because what I'm thinking I'm seeing is that we're then putting science, you know, like if I go to the dentist, I don't need him to know how I feel. I don't need him to know whether I'm a Gemini or not, or, you know, that I'm gay or anything like that. I just need him to really know about teeth, you know. And I definitely don't want him to be worshipping things at the moment. I just want him to do my teeth, you know. And you really want that, don't you? You definitely don't want him.
Yeah, well, this is the importance of categories, is that, yes, a lot of people, it is very meaningful to them to have a faith tradition. They, of course, can also believe that this is objectively true, but that it is not discernible through empirical research. And we just need them to not try and fly planes with that, or
do dentistry with that. You know,
yes. So just having that in the right place. Alan Watts has a wonderful thing about the prickly people who are like me, very very much empiricist, materialist, and the gooey people who are very much spiritual and about the stories, the wisdom of meaning that are put. And he said, most people are things are gooey prickles and prickly goo. Right, so these do work together.
Right, yeah.
If you're too much of one or too much of the other, you're missing out on a lot of life, of what it means to be human. But you do have to have these in the right place. When you're developing medicines, it really does have to be scientific. I'm dealing with an issue at the moment where they're trying to get Maori beliefs to replace science. That's going to be disastrous. But if you're in the arts, or you're looking at literature, then you don't have to evidence absolutely everything. So if you want to write something about vampires, it doesn't actually matter that they don't exist.
And is it true that there is a sort of a war on science to some degree?
Oh, absolutely, it is, and there's a concept called research justice, in which it is claimed that science is valued because it is a white, Western masculinized way of knowing, and research justice or epistemic justice would include other ways of knowing which are not rooted in empirical research. And so, of course, the qualitative studies of how people are thinking and feeling, this is perfectly valid. But when you're trying to establish what is true, not all methods of research are equally valid. And I think you have to, if you want to get another method in there, then you have to justify that if you're going to claim it's true.
I think that's very, very important, isn't it? So let's sort of start to round up with something, you know, because I've been sort of trying to present the sort of Buddhist vision, and I want to make sure I've done justice to that as much as I can, as well as the justice I hope to you.
Yes, you are definitely allowed to talk about Buddhism.
I'm good, I'm glad about that. you know, because we've been talking, you know, I've already said that you know, how much Buddhism values the individual, not in this modern sort of individualistic, broken off, you know, narcissistic way, but, you know, you try it for yourself, you know, and ethics of intention. Your intentions really matter, your actions matter. And then I've said that Buddhism really values the fact that we're in this together. For me, that's been one of the great motivations of my life. It's not just trying to solve my own suffering, which seems to me to be un-Buddhist, just you know, thinking about myself, but trying to help with suffering. I even believe that that's what we're trying to do just now, is trying to say, very difficult to help with suffering. Let's see how we're doing with that, you know. And you've made this distinction between social justice and critical social justice. But of course, in Buddhism, it's not just about improving oneself in an everyday way, valuable though that is and essential though that is. And some Buddhists try and get around that, I'm afraid. But none of us are perfect. It's about seeing that there's something actually, this is one of the reasons why I'm interested in your writing, because seeing that there's something beyond language, that language doesn't capture all of experience, and that there are realms of experience, even realms, dare one say, that I've touched on myself at times, which are beyond language, beyond anything I can say. They're beyond. The trouble is, sometimes Buddhists, if they're not careful enough, say it's beyond. They're beyond ethics. They don't mean that. They mean they're supra ethical, in the sense that they're beyond simply just doing good. The Buddhism would usually use the language of transcendence. There's something beyond the material world. There's something, you know. I said that at the start, I talked to Rupert Sheldrake, and I was interested in that because of his critique of metaphysical materialism, the idea that reality is basically material, and that consciousness is an epiphenomena of the brain. Buddhism would say, actually, there's much more to life than that. There's something profoundly more important going on. That let's just gloss that term transcendental. I wonder where you might be on that kind of thought.
Me on transcendentalism?
Yeah.
Nowhere at all. I tend to back quietly out of the room whenever anybody talks about the transcendental.
Say why?
Well, it isn't the terms. I think like spiritual and transcendental and metaphysical don't feel meaningful to me, and are not interesting to me. So this is why I have, when I'm interested in various sort of traditions. I've been interested in Christianity. I studied that for a long time. I'm interested in Norse mythology. Mm. I haven't found Buddhism or other sort of approaches to spirituality that focus on transcendentalism to hold my attention for very long. And I think this is simply a personality trait. So I settle with defending the rights of Buddhists, to do that, finding common ground with them where we do have them. But when people start to speak of the spiritual or the transcendental, I tend to fall asleep.
It's funny you say that, because I once did this talk with my youngest daughter, and she was only 9 at the time, and she said, what are you going to talk about? And I said, do you want to come in and listen to the talk? She said, what are you going to talk about? I said, I'm going to talk about enlightenment. She said, that sounds boring. So she, I think she'd be very much in union with you there. Anyway, this is probably a good time to finish, because I don't want to put you to sleep by talking. It would be a bad way to finish, wouldn't it, if I managed to put you to sleep by talking about the transcendental. It's interesting, that word spiritual, I hate that word now. Someone's defined it as benign whateverism, which is a very, you know, I'd like to say I'm religious but not spiritual, you know, because spiritual has become, for me, I mean, of course you all have different views and you're allowed to have your views, I'm allowed to have mine, you're allowed to have yours about falling asleep, But, you know, for me, it's just too woozy for words, you know. So I'd be falling asleep if people talked about spiritual. But I just really want to thank you very, very much, Helen, for coming. It's been a delight to meet you personally. Delight to read your book, which I loved. And really delightful to be in conversation with you this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much.